Okay, so yesterday I showed you a powerful tool of Green's functions, but I showed you a very trivial method how to construct them. I showed you only this method of images, which works in certain cases, but it's not general enough, so you wouldn't be able to construct a Green's function for more general cases. But one tool which actually helps is Fourier transform. So today I will mostly do Fourier transform, and that will help us to construct other Green's functions. Which are physically interesting. Okay, so part two, and that will be Fourier transform. Let me start with something slightly more general, just so that you have heard that name. So definition. More generally, what we mean by integral transform. And as the name suggests, it has something to do with integrals, right? So basically, the general definition is that I define a new function. So given a function f, I define a new function f hat of a new variable k, which will be an integral from a to b, which are some boundaries. And then there is something, and then the original function and dt. OK. And this something, so that's general formula. So once we determine what A and B are and what this thing is, then we have defined our integral transform. So this thing is called kernel of the integral transform. And the best probably will be if I give you some examples. So examples. You, I'm sure, know. Well, first, you definitely know, but maybe you haven't seen it in this form, and that's Fourier series. Who haven't seen Fourier series? Everybody's seen, it's great. So now, Fourier series that I expand my function into some series, an infinite series, in sines and cosines and so on. But you can also define a finite sum. So basically, if you sum not all the way up to infinity, but you sum only up to n, then this partial sum, I'll denote by Sn. And then for a given function f, and the new variable will be k. And I claim, actually, that this partial sum, not summing all the way to infinity, but only to n, is precisely of this form. And it's given by, so a and b are pi and minus pi. It's minus pi to pi. Then I have my original function. And then dn t minus k dt, where this dn is called Dirichlet kernel. And it's given by, if you want, the precise formula. So it's given 1 over 2 pi and sine m plus 1 half p minus k divided by sine t minus k divided by 2. So the statement is that this is actually the sum, the Fourier series sum, where you sum only all the way up to n, not to infinity. And that's the kernel. So now what we would like, of course, we would like that this sum really represents my function f, right? So how that can happen, what do you think? How that can happen? So I want this to be basically fk, when I go with n to infinity. So what do I need from this Dirichlet kernel that it actually works? Exactly. So what must happen is actually that as I increase n, as I go with n to infinity, this thing approaches a delta function, delta t minus k. And you can check that if you want. So this is your formula. Go with n to infinity and show that it, maybe Dan showed you in his course that this actually approaches the delta function. Okay, so who has seen that? Nobody has seen. Oh, a few. Very good. Okay, so that was first example. Just putting something very known to less familiar form. Second example, I'm sure also everybody knows, is the Laplace transform. And for that, a equals to 0, so integrate from 0, b equals to infinity, and k dk is just an exponential minus kt. And that is the Laplace transform, special case of an integral transform. And I'm sure you've studied some examples on Laplace transform. So now we are going to something more involved, which will be Fourier transform. So let me define a definition. And let me call it Fourier integral formula. Why I don't call it Fourier transform, I will just mention in a minute. So Fourier integral formula. And now you can look into your handouts number one. So you don't have to actually write many things, at least in the first half. So I'll write it again. So you define a new function f hat of k, or sometimes I'll write f of k. So this is the variable. This is the function which we started with, and that's the Fourier transform of this variable. And then in general, if I'm in d-dimensions, in d-dimensional Euclidean space, and I have f of x, so x is now a vector, so it's x1, x2, x3, up to xd, and e minus I x time k, well, this is a scalar product, so it's x1 k1 plus x2 k2, and so on, and xd kd. And this is a d-dimensional integral dx. Okay, so that's a Fourier integral formula. But there is another one, which is this f with this inverse hat. Okay. And that's defined, I'll write it like f minus 1, f and k. For this point, this is just a symbol. Doesn't mean anything. And I define it to be 1 over 2 pi to power d, rd. So basically the same formula, but now this, instead of minus, there'll be plus e to I x dot k dk. Let me call this Fourier transform. Okay, so that will be basically what most physicists work with, these formulas. But of course, this is not the whole Fourier transform. This is just an integral formula. So in general, you know, if you look at this, then you know this is at most one, right? It's some cosines and sines. So this is at most one, if this is nice and real and whatever. So this integral formula will exist if actually the integral of f of x exists. So if you are actually Lebesgue integrable functions, if your f belongs to L1. But the statement is that you can define Fourier transform for much more general functions. And moreover, Lebesgue integrable 1 functions are not good functions because the Fourier transform from L1 doesn't give you L1 again. So it gives you something else. So there are tricks how to actually extend Fourier transform to much wider class and much nicer class of functions. But you don't have a nice integral formula for those. You know, you get it like limits and so on, limits of series. And there's whole theory behind all this. But for us, this is absolutely sufficient. OK. So now I'll calculate one Fourier transform. Of course, the simplest one, yes?
If x should be in fk.
Thank you. Okay, and one more thing I wanted to say when you asked me that question. So basically, where you put 2 pi, it's completely arbitrary. So some people put 1 over 2 pi to d half here, and 1 over 2 pi d half here. Some people put all the 2 pi here, and so on. So this, I tried this to be a physics convention. So if you do quantum mechanics or whatever, then you'll probably see these formulas. But it varies from book to book. So where you stick your 2 pi, it's completely basically arbitrary. Another point is to say 2 pi equal to 1, which is also possible. OK, so let me calculate one of them. And as I said, it's the simplest one. I cannot really do these complicated examples. So example. And of course, that's the exponential. So I'll be interested now x is, so I'll be really in R to D, so in D dimensions. And I want to calculate the Fourier transform of the exponential. This is the norm of x, so it's again x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared over 2 and k. Okay, so now I plug it into the formula. So this is an integral to the d e minus x squared over 2 minus I k times x dx. So now you have a whole course on this, right? So you immediately know the result. What is the result? Huh?
2/1
Almost, yeah. Okay. So let me just remind Gaussian integration. So there's only one integral every physicist should remember. And that's an integral, one-dimensional integral from minus infinity to infinity, e to minus ax squared. And if you remember that, that's pi over a. And there's some data tricks how to calculate that. So that's one-dimensional integral. So now if I have something more complicated, then I have minus ix squared minus bx, then you complete the squares. And so let's. Very simple. So you write it like minus integral infinity to infinity, e to minus a. And now I put x plus b over 2a square minus b square over 4a square. And if you actually multiply everything out, you'll find out that it is actually indeed equal to that. And then you change variables. So you'll call this epsilon. And then this is just a constant, so you pull it out of the integral. So this is e to b squared over 4a. I'm just pulling out this part. And then I change x to y, and it's precisely of this form now. Right? So then you have an integral from minus infinity to infinity, e to minus I y squared dy. And that's using the previous result, it's pi over a, e to b squared over 4a. OK. So that's what everybody knows now. I just did the exercise for myself. So now, of course, I want to use basically this formula for that purpose. And I don't really care that there are some i's and so on. So I'll just, you know, so using this, I see that I have to identify a to b minus, a to b plus 1/2, and B to be IK. Okay, so I said A to be 1/2, B to be IK. Of course, there's some analytic continuation of this thing, but who cares? And so using that result, you must get 2 pi to B over 2 e to minus k square over 2. So that's the Fourier transform which we have calculated. And in some sense, this is amazing, right? Because what we have discovered at this point is that if you start with the exponential and do the Fourier transform up to some funny constants which are 1 anyway, as we said 2 pi equal to 1, then it's the same exponential, right? So that's great. So what does it mean? It means that if I actually apply now f minus 1 and do the same trick. So now I'll calculate f minus 1 of this thing. So f minus 1 to e minus k square over 2 and 2 pi t half. So I'm just taking this result here and use the inverse integral formula. It's on here. It's the same procedure, right? I mean, just using the same Gaussian integration, everything remains the same. And so what you discover, that this is nothing else than x squared over 2. Okay. So this is amazing. So what it actually tells us, that this f minus 1 looks like an inverse. Right? So this is my proof that it is an inverse formula. the proof, the actual proof takes several pages to show that, and it's very involved. But I think by demonstration, I convince you that these two things are indeed inverse formulas. Okay, very good. Questions? Yes?
How exactly is the Fourier transform related to Fourier series?
So basically, you can do Fourier series if you have function defined on a finite interval. If you want this interval to go to all the way up to infinity, you cannot use Fourier series. You have to use Fourier transform. So basically, anytime you have infinite function on an infinite support, you need to use this one. And they are very much related, other than that. But it's for finite or for infinite. It's basically. All right. Questions? Comments? So, two lessons really to carry home. Fourier transform exponential is exponential, and these two things are inverse formulas. Yes?
Can I just see that the Gaussian function is the eigenvector of the Fourier transformation?
That's a good question. If you want to put it that way, maybe you are not far from the truth. I don't know. I never thought about it this way.
Okay.
But yeah, it seems that it's possible. Sat, did you have a question?
Yeah, just regarding Jason's question. I always saw the Fourier transforms as like a transformation from one set of, I don't know, one representation to another, like position representation to phase representation. Then I don't see how you can justify that with the connection to Fourier series.
Actually, you can. You just take the interval, let them go to infinity. You will see Fourier transform as a limit.
Of the Fourier series?
Yeah, as a limit of the Fourier series, you can see it.
Yeah,
yeah,
but
the Fourier series is mode space
but that's not if I just take the Fourier sum is a discrete sum. If you just make an integral,
right.
That doesn't.
Could I have a present for you?
Pardon?
Okay, that was not clever. Anyway, so that's the present, but you don't have to write it down because you already have it in your handouts, right? So anyway, so these are the properties of the Fourier transform. Okay, so I'll lower them down. And it's a theorem which, of course, has a proof, and I'll prove some of the properties. Some of them you will prove, and some of them will stay unproven. Okay. Okay, so what the theorem says that if I have two functions, f and g, which actually belong to our Lebesgue integrable or Lebesgue square integrable, well, at the same time. So this is for this function, your integral formula exists, but the inversion doesn't have to exist. And for L2 is nice thing because Fourier transform goes from L2 to L2, so L2 is nice. So for simplicity, and you can extend it to more complicated cases, but let's consider just this thing here. Then the statement is, first of all, the Fourier transform of a function is a continuous function. So it's a nice function, it's a continuous function. Then there's this lemma, Riemann-Lebesgue lemma, that if you take a limit of the Fourier transform function, k goes to infinity, you must necessarily get zero. So if you go all the way to infinity, the image actually goes to zero. Okay, and there's this convolution property. I haven't defined convolution, my mistake. So let me define convolution. I don't have definition here, so I'll have to make it. Okay. You don't need this. So convolution is a very special transformation. So basically you define, you have two functions, f and g, and this is convolution, and you want to define them as a function of x. So it gives you a new function, and this is given by an integration over the whole space, f of x, g of x minus y, and dy. So this is a definition of the convolution. Convolution has many applications in physics. It governs the models of population growth and so on. Basically, you can see it everywhere in physics. But from our perspective, the most interesting property is that under the Fourier transformation, convolution actually behaves very nicely. So it's not the product of functions. If you take a Fourier transform of product of two functions, you get something relatively ugly. But if you take actually a convolution and you take the Fourier transform of this convolution, then you just get product of convolutions, product of Fourier images. So this is actually a very nice property of the convolution. And you will prove this in the tutorial tomorrow for me. Okay, so that's great. Then there is a shift. So if I shift my variable x by some value a, then I get that the image just gets multiplied by ika. This is so simple that maybe I can even prove this if you want. So I can prove that. Then scale. So if I scale my x, then what it does is actually in the Fourier image, I get 1 over a to d. And k over a in the image. So this is how you scale things. And that's, again, very simple to prove. Now, the most used property of the Fourier transform is how actually you deal with derivatives. And this is very nice because you start with a derivative of a function and the Fourier transform changes that by simple multiplication by k. Right? So this is very useful. So I have a differential equation. I Fourier transform that. And instead of derivatives, I suddenly have to solve algebraic equation where I multiply everything by k. So that's amazing. This is the inverse property. If I multiply, then I get a derivative there. And I may prove this in a very simple case. So maybe I'll prove this. Then you have seen Percival's equality, which we may prove as well, but we shall see. So if you have two functions and you form their norm, so what is the norm? In L2 is just an integral of the function f and integral of the function g. Okay, so this is an integral r to d. Left-hand side is f of x. Now, if the function is complex, then you put g of x and d of x. So that will be the left-hand side. And the right-hand side is the same thing, but now with the Fourier images. So what it tells you is that actually the Fourier transform basically preserves the norm. So it's very important for quantum mechanics. Okay. Then this is very difficult to prove that f and f minus 1 are inversions, but I proved it. And then this will also be useful for physics, and probably you have seen that in Dan's course, that you can represent delta function as an integral over ik x minus y. So basically, what it tells you is that the delta function is a Fourier transform of 1. Okay. Questions to the properties? Okay, so let me prove just the derivative property is the simplest proof I can do. So let me do that. And let me do it in one dimension, so that it is okay. And I want to mix now. Okay, so you put 6a for proof. 6a. And in one dimension, so I have df over dx at k. So now this is an integral just over r. If I'm in one dimension, I choose my integral formula, so it's df over dx e to minus I kx dx. Okay. And now I use integration by parts. Okay. So I shift this derivative here to the other one. There are some boundary terms. Well, everything is nice and smooth, at infinity vanishes, whatever, so boundary terms do not contribute. And I have f d over dx e to minus I k times x dx. I can differentiate exponential. That's simple, right? It picks up minus ik. So it's minus minus ik is plus ik. So it's ik integral f e minus I kx dx. And that's what I had before. So this is ik f hat of k. So that's proof of 6a. One more simple I could do, maybe. Maybe not. Let's not do it. Maybe let's do the shift. Shift is also simple. So four. So I want to calculate a Fourier transform of f x plus a, which is an integral r f x plus a e to I k times x minus dx. And then I just simply change the variables. I call x plus a to be y. Be y, which means x is y minus a. So and the measure doesn't change. Dx is dy. This integral over r. F of y minus I k, and instead of x I write y minus a on dy. And I pull this I k a outside, and I have e to I k a integral r f of y e to minus I k y dy, which is what I wanted. Hopefully, f of k. So that's proof of the shift property. It's actually a very useful property. It looks trivial, but it's a very useful property if you are solving, for example, difference equations, as you will see tomorrow in the tutorial. So this is a very useful property. Scale property is also simple to prove. And Parseval, we shall see, and delta function I will show you in a fancy language of quantum mechanics how to prove that. Okay? So that's the proof of the theorem. And now I want to do something really, really fancy. And that is, I want to solve for you the Cauchy problem for the diffusion equation, which is something really, really fancy. And it will require, you know, some pain. It will be painful, but not really. Okay. So, diffusion equation is a very nice equation in physics. Some say it's the most fundamental equation. In fact, it has the form, basically, of a Schrödinger equation. So it's first time, first derivative in time, and then it has the Laplace thing. So it's basically the Poisson equation, but now with time derivative. So, example. And I don't know if you did study heat kernel in Dunn's course. Did you? No?
Yes. So, so the Fourier transform can map you from a real valued function to a complex valued function?
In general, it is defined for complex functions. You can start with complex functions. And as long as these integrals converge, you are fine. Okay. Yeah. So. But yeah, so in general, you get complex. Yes.
Regarding the kernel of the transform, that always has to be a set of orthonormal functions, right? As you move through your parameter.
I think, well, in general, you can put anything you want. Question is it useful, right? I think. But probably you may be right that actually probably useful are only those if you have a full set of. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but in general, you can put anything you want, right? You can call an integral transform anything you want. But I think you're right. So this fancy thing is solve the Cauchy problem. Cauchy problem. I will explain in a minute what that means. For the diffusion equation. So first, what is diffusion equation? So I have some function u, which is function of time and space. And that satisfies an equation du over dt minus the Laplace operator, which you've seen yesterday, so it's Laplace square, and equals to, in general, it can be force thing, so you can have an arbitrary function on the right-hand side. So function of t and x, and I will let t to go from 0 to some big t, and x will be, I'll solve it in, you know, without boundary conditions. It will be already complicated. So basically, we'll be doing analog of solving this free space green function, G3, as we did yesterday, but now for more complicated equation. So this will be RD. So I will not consider any boundaries. But Cauchy problem, it means that I define my function to be at some time equal to 0. So u at time equal to 0 of x, I'll call u0. And that's a Cauchy problem. So you want to, so you specify, for example, that the temperature in the room at some time, and then you are interested how this evolves in time. What will be the solution? Yes?
The fact that you don't have boundary conditions for x, it's, I mean, we're choosing that so that we can do a Fourier transform.
Yeah.
But if I have, for example, boundary conditions, the Fourier transform can be done as well? Or?
I think it's more complicated. Yeah, it will be more complicated. I'm doing the simplest thing again. I think. Yeah, I don't know how to do it generally. Okay, so that's our problem. Who knows the solution? Nobody? It's perfect. So let me go very, very slowly. So first, I told you it's an application on the Fourier transform, so we do Fourier transform. But so now you can choose actually to do Fourier transform in whatever variables you want. But for our purpose, it would be the most convenient actually to Fourier transform only in x. So we leave t untouched, and then we transform in x only. So Fourier transform in x. OK, so what do we have? So I just write hat if I did my Fourier transform. So I have t, u hat. Of course, Fourier transforms, again, commutes with d over dt. And we are in physics, so it's du over dt. OK, and now I have this Laplace operator, which is basically two derivatives. I'm using the property 6. So for each derivative, I pick up ik. So I have two of them, so I pick up ik square. So I square is minus 1. That is minus already, so it will be plus k square u hat equals to f hat. OK, so far so simple. So now this is also very simple to solve. So if you look at this equation, it's a first order equation for u hat in time with constant this thing and with some right-hand side f. So there are many ways how to solve it. So this is a linear equation, linear first order equation, first order in t. And I like the most the method of integration factor. There are many other methods of integration factor. So let me remind you what this is. Okay. So in general, if I have dy over dt plus some constant ay equal to b, then what I do is this equation. So this is a symbol that I'm saying I will do this equation something. So I'll multiply it by e to, well, y is here a function of. Why? Let's put tau. Y is function of tau. So I multiply by exponential, a is the same a as here, and e to tau. And then I stare at the left-hand side. So what I have on the right-hand side is b times e to a tau, right? Tau. And on the left-hand side, if you look at that, I'll write it down. It's y to e to tau, and the derivative with respect to tau. Is that true? So if I differentiate it, I get y dot times e to tau, a to tau. And then if I differentiate this one, I just bring down a. And this is what I had before. All right, so this is good. I can write basically the first, well, I can write it like that. And then I can integrate it, right? So now I integrate it from 0 to t d tau. OK, so again, right-hand side is simple. So it's 0 to t d tau b e to a tau. OK, and then the left-hand side is also simple because it's a total derivative. So I basically just pick up the values in boundaries, right? So I have y of t e to a t. Minus y at 0, and e to a 0 is 1. So that's it. OK, so I immediately have the solution. Mm-hmm. that y of t equals to, so I just move everything to the other side, so it's y 0 e to minus at plus integral from 0 to t d tau b e a tau minus t, I think. And that's the solution of a first order equation with the right hand side. So you can do it by, I don't know, probably variation of constants, maybe, I don't know. There are many other methods how to do this. Just let me tell you, this will work also if A and B are matrices. Well, if A is matrix and B is a vector, it will also work. But then I have to be careful where actually it stands. So if this is a vector and this is a matrix, then I'd rather have this first and then that second and so on. So this works in more general cases for the system of equations as well. Okay, very good. So that's the general procedure. So what is the solution for U hat? So U hat equals to?
E to the minus k squared t.
E to the minus k squared t.
F hat.
And?
K t prime.
Okay. So this function b is a function of, can be a function of tau. So tau. Okay. D tau. Okay. Very good. Thank you. So far so good. So we have found what U hat is at this point. So the only thing what we have to do now is actually return back to find U. So we have to do the inverse Fourier transform. Okay. And I'll do it by trick. So neat inverse Fourier transform for this. So far, everybody's happy. So far, it's very simple, right? Piece of cake. So now, trick. And that trick is actually what we have calculated already, and that's why I calculated it was the third point which I didn't say, is that we know how to Fourier transform exponentials. Right? So we know that e to minus k squared over 2 is 1 over 2 pi d over 2 Fourier transform of minus x squared over 2, like that. But this is what I derived. Right? And also our proof of inverse Fourier transform. So we know how to do this. So now, this is almost what we need, but not entirely. We need e to k squared t. That's what we see in the equation. But we have e to a squared, k squared over 2. Okay? So why don't we use one of the properties, and that will be the scaling property 5. So let us use the scaling property 5, and let us define that scaling factor a to be something so that we get, instead of this guy, we get that guy. Okay. So what do I have to choose for A? Almost, yeah. 1 over 2t. So if I do that, then I will get that e to minus k squared t equals to, and now I'm using this formula and that formula for the scaling. So for that scaling, that I pick a factor 1 over something, 1 over a to some power, and then I scale what is in that Fourier transform. And if you do that, you will find out that this is 1 over 2t d over 2, that's the scaling factor a. Then we had before, this thing is still there. So 1 over 2 pi d over 2, and then e to minus x squared over 4t Fourier transform. Right? Well, yeah, I chose to, okay, so this is 5. And you have that. Of course, if you don't believe this, you can calculate it from the scratch. But why not use the property if you have it, right? Okay, so that's very good. So now we see that this thing here is something important, right? It's an exponential, so it must be important. And it has both variables. It has x and t, so it must be important. Okay, so now what you do is just define important property to be something, a shortcut for your important property. Okay. So definition, let's call gtx, we define it to be 1 over 2t, d over 2, that's what we see over there, and then exponential minus x squared over 4t. And this function is called heat kernel. It's so important that it has its own name. Okay, so that's just a definition, and we define it because we know that e to minus k squared over t is something like Fourier transform of this. But now we are done. We are done if we realize the property for the convolution, which is property number 3. So you see that if you have a Fourier transform of a convolution, then you get a product of 2 Fourier transforms, right? So now if you look at the equation for u hat, we have u0 hat, and then there is exponential e to minus k squared t. And we know that that is actually a Fourier transform of our heat kernel, right? So what it means is that I can write u hat t and k. They sum this stupid factor 2 pi d over 2. And then there's a u0 times that. So I use the left-hand side of the convolution property. So this is u0 convolution with my heat kernel. And the whole thing is Fourier transformed. K and T. That's the first term. So here is property 3, is it? For 3, I'm using the convolution property. Sorry? Okay, so I have u0 hat times g hat. Right? And I'm using the left-hand side of that. So that will be Fourier transform of u times convolution times g. Right? Okay. And then the same thing here. So now I have 0 to t for the second term. And then I have, again, f hat, and then a g hat, basically. So again, I put them at like a convolution and make it Fourier transform. So this will be 0 to t, f, tau, some variable for the convolution, g, t minus tau, and the whole thing is hat, k, d tau.
Isn't that one already a convolution?
But it's a convolution in time, not in
x. Yeah, convolution is in time, whereas the Fourier transform is in x. So I transform x to k. Yeah, very good. Thank you. Okay, and now look at that beauty. So on the left-hand side, I have something underneath the hat. And on the right-hand side, I have a constant and something underneath the head and something underneath the head. So why don't I destroy the heads, right? I look underneath the heads. And that must be true, right? So let me do it. Sorry for deleting these things. And that's the solution, right? OK. So really, that's a trick. So
you gotta change the case for the
case. Yeah, right. Okay. So I was too hasty, okay. So I will give you time to write it down. So if I'll change, yeah, right. I have to change K to X, and then I have to change to X, and then I have to change here to X. And that's almost true right now. So now, if you want, you can write it explicitly. So you can use this definition of the convolution to write it explicitly down. But anyway, I'll write it down in a minute. But what it tells you is that your solution depends on the initial solution here in this term. And it depends on the fourth term of your equation. And that's the second term. Right? So now if I, for example, set t equal to 0, this rather be u0, right? So if I set t equal to 0 here, the integral is gone. And that vanishes. And the point is whether if I set t equal to 0 of this thing here, the convolution is in time, whether this really goes to u0. And you haven't proved it really this done this year. OK, you haven't. OK. So you can ask Dan. He had a tutorial on it last year. Actually, that you can show that it's indeed gives you u0. So anyway, so let's write it explicitly down. So it's 1 over 2 pi d over 2. And now I have this big bracket. So now the convolution, what is it I'm writing? Sorry, I said something stupid. So the convolution is actually in X, right? The convolution is in X. Yeah, I said something stupid. OK, R to the D. Now, let me write what G is this exponential. So it's e to x minus y square over 4t, 2t. That's just plugging what G is, d over 2, u0 at y, d and y. So that's convolution u is my kernel. And now this is even more complicated expression because I have one more integral from 0 to t. And then another integral for the convolution, r to the d, e minus x minus y square over 4 t minus tau, 2 times t minus tau d half, and f tau y dy d tau. So that's the whole most general solution of this Cauchy problem. It's terrible, right? It's terrible. But it's beautiful that you can actually solve it using Fourier transform. And that it's very simple. And you even didn't have to do the inverse Fourier transform. You just use this convolution property and look underneath the heads. And that's the most beautiful part, that you don't have to do the inverse Fourier transform. Because what usually happens, maybe if you have some experience with Laplace transform or whatever, if you are solving differential equations, you can easily, do the Laplace transform, make it algebraic equation. You solve that algebraic equation, so you have the solution in the K space. But returning back to the X space, you have to do the inverse Laplace transform, and that's usually painful. But here we didn't have to do it; we just look underneath the heads, and that was the whole thing.
Oh.
Yes.
Whenever I have some equation that has time and position, we did the Fourier transform just in the position, right? But one can also do it both in time and position, right? Which is more convenient?
At this point, I think that here, because you can solve this equation for t explicitly, it's better to do it this way, because usually you cannot solve it.
Now, and what if I take the diffusion equation and I put an I where you have the ddt?
Okay, then you have Schrodinger equation. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How the solutions change?
That's a good question. I don't know. I would naively say that it shouldn't, but
they become time reversible, just like Schrodinger equation solutions are.
Yeah, there may be some problems. Yeah. Okay. Questions to everybody. Okay. Very good. So then, let me just make two remarks. So one of the remarks is that you can derive the same solution by path integral, and maybe you will do it in quantum mechanics course. So path integral will lead to the same solution. But you'll be basically doing Schrodinger equation, but a lot of this. Another thing is that actually this equation is sometimes used in numerical approach to solve, for example, the Poisson equation which you've seen yesterday. So let's say that you want to solve, you have some weird domain and you want to solve Poisson equation, the electrostatics in the domain. So how you do that in numerics is actually you promote this, your function phi, now u, to be function of time. And then what you do is that, so you put it on the grid, and then you take an arbitrary initial solution. And then this solution actually let the solution flow. So which means that you recalculate, so you write, instead of differential equation, you write difference equation, and you let this evolve. So in next time, the solution will be slightly different, the solution will be slightly different, and so on, using this difference equation. So you use left point to calculate right point and so on and so on and so on in time, and then you move the time and so on. But at some point, the solution will not change anymore. So for generic initial data, the solution will not change anymore. And in that case, du over dt is actually zero, and you solve the Poisson equation. So this is how you do it in numerical approach. So really, you are solving this equation rather than Poisson equation itself. You promote another variable time, and then change the solution in time, recalculate the solution in time steps, and then when the solution doesn't change, you have the solution of the Poisson equation. Okay, do you want 2 minute break, or shall we continue? Yes?
So, in that one you just described doing it numerically, why wouldn't you just be able to use this one and not do it numerically? I mean,
So here we have solved the problem without any boundaries, without any domain. So this was an infinite domain.
Yeah.
You had fourth term there, but it was an infinite domain. So if you want, for example, to solve Poisson equation in some very weird domain where you are not able to use method of images or you are not able to use something, then you usually solve it numerically. And the trick is actually to solve a different equation, to solve this equation.
Is it true that in this case, if I don't take some weird boundary and I take the limit of t going to zero, the solution should be the solution of Poisson equation?
Not t going to zero, du dt.
Yeah, but if t goes to zero, the solution will have no time dependent. Will be the steady state solution.
Yeah, but then you just went back to the same. Then the numerics aren't
helpful. So, do you want 1 minute break? No? Let's finish it. Okay. So, that was one example. Another example is, which was already mentioned here in the class, is Fourier transforming quantum mechanics. And you already know the result. That is that actually, if you are in position space, this is basically a Fourier transform of if you are in the momentum space. But, and I'm sure this was done by Egi as well, but let me just use this language. So you have state psi, and specifically, you can consider eigenstates. This is just to remind you the language. I'm sure you have seen that, of operators k. Of operators x hat, the position operator, and p hat, the momentum operator. So what does it mean? And question is, have you seen this notation? and I saw it for the first time, x and x is x on x. That's great, right? So this is an operator. This is a state or eigenstate. This is the eigenvalue, and this is an eigenstate. And similarly, p on p is p on p, right? Okay. So now, what you were told probably is that these eigenstates, they form a complete basis, which is autonormal. So complete autonormal basis. So what does it mean is that I can basically write 1 as sum over x, right? So it's sum over x and x. That's how people usually write it. But of course, you know that x is continuous variable, so it can take any value. It's not discrete. So but this is a shortcut for basically an integral x or x dx, the integration variable now. So anyway, so people usually write it like that. And then you know that what does it mean that it's autonormal? So if I have x and x prime, this is delta x minus x prime, or just a normal delta function if it is discrete. And then similarly for p, that's also a complete basis. But now if you want to write it more specifically as an integral, then actually what's hiding here in this sum and in this is that there is 1 over 2 pi again. So if you set it, well, I don't know. So 1 over 2 pi to the power d and p and p and dp. That's what it means. Okay, so that's just using the fact that we know that the eigenstates of the operators x and p form an orthonormal complete basis. So now what does it mean that I talk about, so I have state psi, but I can talk about the state in various representations. So in x representation, and that's what you usually call a wave function. So you write psi of x, which will be just scale product x and psi. Okay. So now I'm not sure if you've seen that, but let's see. So now I calculate the expectation value of my x operator. So this is my x operator, and I calculate the expectation value of psi and x. Okay. So how do I do it? So I use, of course, my eigenvalue equation. So I let x to act on that. So what it means, and I don't know if you've seen this. So it means that the x operator is now in x representation, okay? And then x and psi, okay? But I can use my eigenvalue equation, so actually x acting on x, it just gives you eigenvalue of x, right? So this equals to x, and this is psi x, right? So psi x. Okay, so what does it mean is that basically if you are thinking about the x operator in the x representation, then it's just what it does for you is just multiply by x, right? So acts like multiplication. And this is an operator. In x representation. Okay. So that's the second piece of information we need. Third piece of information, so that the quantum mechanics is complete. I'm just doing quantum mechanics in 10 minutes, right? So it's the whole quantum mechanics. So I want to, so in order I have three quantum mechanics, I want commutation relations, right? I want that X and P are equal to something. I h bar is 1. So I want this. Okay, and that's the whole quantum mechanics. So you promote X and P to from classical mechanics to operators, and you promote this to be commutation relations, and that's basically quantum mechanics, right? Okay, very good. So what does it mean? So I want to satisfy this. So let's see now what happens if I calculate the same expectation value, but now of the P operator. Okay, so this will be P operator in X representation, X and psi. And then there is a unique theorem, I think by Neumann or somebody like that. And it tells you that this actually must be a derivative operator. Minus I over D over DX. Psi of X. And the statement is that, so the momentum operator in X representation must act like a derivative. And the statement is that this is a unique solution of these commutation relations. So if I want to satisfy these commutation relations, there's no other solution than this one here and that one there. So it's so this satisfies commutation relation, and it's actually basically a unique solution. Okay. So finally, where is our Fourier transform? So in order to find our Fourier transform, let's first calculate what is, again, an expectation value of the P operator, now sandwiched by X and P. So if I act on this state, I get P times X and P, right? If I act on that state, I get operator P in the X representation. So this equals to P in X representation, X and P. Right? So this is acting on the right. That is acting on the left. P acting on the X representation is the derivative. So this is minus I d over dx, X and P. Hallelujah. So we have a differential equation for X and P. So this is P times X and P is minus E d over dx, X and P. So this is my differential equation, which I can solve, and of course the solution is the exponential, right? So from here, I know that X and P is the exponential, P times X. It's solving this differential equation. Okay. So finally, I can talk about not wave function in the X space, but I can talk about the wave function in the P space, right? So P representation so I define wave function as a function of momentum P now, similar to what I have done with X, but now with P. Now I insert 1. So I haven't done anything. Px, x, and phi. Right? Then this is psi of x. This I derive, it's e to p times x. And so I write it as an integral psi of x e to minus I p times x dx. So p representation and x representation are connected by Fourier transform. Something you already knew. Questions, comments? No. So last minute. So Fourier transformation of delta function, which was the property, I don't know, 8 or whatever, 9 maybe, of the delta function. Of course, I assume f is nice. As always, so that my inversion formula actually works. So I'm cheating here, basically. You prove the inversion formula by knowing what the Fourier representation of the delta function is. I'm going the other way around. I'm assuming that I have inversion formula, and then I'll show you that. So what is the delta function? So you have f of x. So now, if the inversion formula works, then this must be an integral r to d dk e to I k times x f of k, right? So that's the inversion formula. So now I expand this, what it means. So it's an integral f of y e to minus I k times y dy. That I'm using the Fourier transform formula. So I have two integrals, which I just rearrange. So you see that I have dk integral and I have dy integral. That's something strange. I have dx integral, sorry. No, that's right. That's right. Okay. So I just rearrange these two integrals, r to d, dy, f of y, why not? Then I put 1 over 2 pi to power d, integral r to d, e to I, k times x minus y, and dk. I just rearranged those integrals. Otherwise, it's exactly the same thing. Clear? OK. So now how this can be? So I have, on the left hand side, I have f of x, and then I have integral of f of y. So this thing must be delta x minus y. And that's the proof of the formula 8. OK. So this was very nice. But I say it was too complicated to show that. So you have this beautiful language of quantum mechanics, the Dirac language of these Brack and Katz and so on. And in that language, you know that x and y, they are orthonormal. Delta x minus y. Right? OK. So let me insert p. So I have x, p, p, and y. Right? And you are done. You are done, because that orthonormality there, so that sum over p is an integral of 1 over 2 pi to d, pp, right? So this is an integral 1 over 2 pi to d integral. And now you know that these guys are exponentials. That's what I derived there, right? So these guys are exponentials. So it's e to I P X minus Y dP. Okay. So that's a simple proof of that. So that language is very, very powerful. It has all the things. It has Fourier transform built in it, basically. And everything in that language is actually very, very simple. Okay, so let me finish here. Questions, comments? So tomorrow will be the most important lecture. We will talk about electromagnetism.